I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. My guest today is Erica L. Sanchez, poet, fiction writer, essayist, and we're going to talk about her most recent book of poems called Lessons on Expulsion. So stick around and we're going to talk to Erica. This will be the very first time I have talked to her, but I've known her for a while. I would say that Erica is my friend. My Facebook friend. I have a lot of Facebook friends, a lot of writers, some of whom I've never met before. When I go to AWP, for example, the big conference where all the creative writers get together, like 11,000 of us, I run into so many friends. I say, oh, I know you, I know what you're doing, but only because of Facebook, and nice to meet you in person. It is amazing how many writer friends are on Facebook that I've been friends with for years but never talked to them. And Erica L. Sanchez is one of them. She is an amazing woman. She is incredibly powerful, and she writes some amazing poetry. And I'm really happy to have her here to celebrate her success with her brand new book of poems. So stick around. Erica L. Sanchez is the daughter of Mexican immigrants. She is a poet, a novelist, and an essayist, and she has recently accepted a visiting faculty position at Princeton Arts Fellow, Princeton University. She is the author of two books, Lessons on Expulsion, which is a collection of poetry from Gray Wolf Press, as well as a novel called I Am Not Your Perfect Mexican Daughter, which was recently released by Knopf Books. We are proud to have her here on Words on a Wire. Erica, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Congratulations on this book of poem, Lessons on Expulsion, out from Gray Wolf Press, which is seriously one of my favorite poetry presses. They're doing some great work right now. We just had Mai Durang on the show. And,
she's great.
Oh, yeah. And I always get their books because they're just such a great publisher of poetry. And how is your relationship with them? How do you like working with them?
They're amazing. I love them. They've been such great editors, and their promotion of the book has been excellent, and I can't say, you know, enough nice things about them. I think they're wonderful, and, you know, publishing with them is a dream come true, because, like you, I really love their poetry books that they put out, and so when I found out about this, I was astounded.
Yeah, to get a first book with Gray Wolf is a really big deal. So how did it happen? Was it a blind submission? Was it a contest? And did you send it out to multiple places like a lot of first-time poets do?
Yeah, I mean, I had been sending it out for years, like many poets do, and had plenty of rejections. And at one point, I thought, well, why the hell not? Let me send it to Gray Wolf. And I had met Jeff Shot at Breadloaf, and he had complimented my work because I did a reading there as a scholar. And so I just sent him a email asking if he would be interested in reading my book, and he was. And so that was wonderful news in itself. And then like several months later, it was picked up. And so it took quite a long time to get a response, but it was worth it.
Well, you have two books that were pretty much accepted at the same time. You had your YA novel, which was accepted by Knopf, and I think that's already out, isn't it?
It should be out in October.
Okay, and then you had this book. So which did you hear about first, and which made you more excited?
I guess I was equally excited for both. Both of them are a dream come true. Yeah. For instance, yeah, I've been dreaming of writing a novel ever since I was a kid, but I've also been writing poetry since I was a kid. And so I first heard about the novel, which is interesting because I had been working on my poetry manuscript for 10 years, and my novel I had been working on for a few years. And so I never imagined that the novel would get picked up first, but that's how it unfolded. I was at a conference and I got an email from my agent, and I was supposed to be listening to a panel, but instead I checked my email. Yeah. I checked my email and I saw that my agent had sold it she told me that Knopf was interested in the book, and I just like lost it.
Did you blurt it out right there on the panel?
I did it. I was listening to the panel. I wasn't on it, thank God, but I was just like astounded, just like staring blankly for a good hour, not knowing what to do, just frozen with excitement and just jitters. And so it was a funny moment because I couldn't tell anyone for a while. I had to sit with it. And so it was kind of excruciating to have that kind of news and not be able to do anything about it.
Oh, my God. That's a great story. You know, I heard you say one time, I don't remember where it was, whether it was on a panel or a talk, or maybe it was even on Facebook, but you said that you would give your left eyeball to read a book about people like me. And I'm wondering, as you were, but you also say that the publishing world is finally starting to catch up on Latinx stories that matter. But I'm wondering, as you were writing this book of poems and even the YA novel, were you aware of that, that you're in a sense communicating with that younger version of yourself that wanted to see books like what you're writing?
Yes, and with my novel, it was much more intentional. I wrote the book that I needed when I was growing up. And with my poetry, I don't think so much about audience until after the fact, but I was also aware that it was something that I would have appreciated when I was a child or a teenager. And that's something that's very important for me, to be able to connect with young people, because I feel like Latinx stories aren't often in the mainstream. And so that was one reason that I kept insisting that my books be published by mainstream publishers. That to me was like just very, very important. And in some ways I felt like I was delusional. I was like, am I crazy for wanting this? But it worked out. So I'm very grateful.
And the fact that you are having your two books almost simultaneously, one from one of the greatest publishers, the biggest, most important, I guess you can say. I mean, although I don't want to in any way diminish independent presses like, Arte Público and Camino del Sol series out of the University of Arizona Press.
No, but they're very valuable.
Oh, they're great. But this is, Knopf, right? And then this is Grey Wolf for poetry. And so immediately, because you are a Latina, whether you like it or not, you are immediately a role model to other Latinas. How do you feel about that role?
Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of responsibility there. And I, in some ways, lament that there aren't more of us. Mm-hmm. Because, I have incredible mentors myself. But as far as women writers, when you think about who is in the mainstream, there aren't many Latinas. And so that's something that's always bothered me.
Right.
And it's not for lack of talent, that's for sure. So now that I've been given this platform, I feel like a great sense of responsibility. I was just thinking about, there's so many female Latina writers that I love, but when they're being discussed, often it's like, Sandra Cisneros and Ana Castillo, which is, they're amazing, but House on Main Street was published in 1984.
Right.
So it's been a long time coming, and I'm not saying that I'm like this new voice or anything like that, but it troubles me that it's taken a long time for us to be part of the mainstream or the canon.
Yeah, well, at the risk of sounding overly flattering, if anybody is going to do something positive for the Latino community with this position, it's you. I mean, you speak out. If an issue bothers you, you speak out on it. And it shows in your poetry, and I imagine it shows in your YA novel as well. And I understand you're writing a collection of essays. I imagine that is going to be a pretty powerful and very political collection.
Yes, thank you. I care very deeply about social issues, and that's manifested in my work in very different ways. So in this collection of essays, I'm writing about my own experiences as, a brown woman in America, struggling to make a life for herself. And, I never really read a lot of essays like the ones that I'm writing. Like recently I read Sandra Cisneros' memoir or her collection of essays. And it was so reassuring to read about her experiences because I could really relate to them.
Right.
And so I want to provide that as well, because I know that a lot of my experiences are common to be a bicultural, bilingual woman of color in this country, and navigating, a career and white spaces and just trying to make something out of my life. That's something that, I think needs to be written about. And I also try to braid in, pop culture and history and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so it's been quite an experience writing this collection. It's very painful, I will say.
We're talking to Erica L. Sanchez about her book of poems, Lessons on Expulsion. Let's go ahead and kind of dip into the poetry a bit. Though the whole idea of poetry, we can talk about essays and fiction on another show, because it's just, I just love what the work that you're doing. But in terms of the poetry, since we're kind of talking about that book, you said that when you were in sixth grade, you were exposed to the poetry of Edgar Allan Poe, and that is when poetry found you. I love that expression, that poetry found you, as opposed to you discovered language or you discovered poetry, which is the narrative which we usually use when we talk about coming into language. How is it that poetry found you?
It sounds a little bit romantic when I talk about it sometimes, but I honestly feel like that's what I was born to do,
right,
to write. And poetry, when it found me, it just illuminated so much. My life made sense. And so I feel like it was meant to happen.
No, that makes sense.
I can't prove that, but that's how it feels to me.
Yeah, well, you're proving it with your work and your life, you know. I mean, you're...
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting that Edgar Allan Poe was involved, and for a personal reason, then also for a reason that I'll get to in just a second. But I remember when I was in third grade, one of the very first poems that we read and that I had to memorize and recite to the class was an Edgar Allan Poe poem. And that kind of brought me into language in a sense. But I'm thinking about his poetry and his fiction, and I'm wondering if there's anything about the darkness of Poe's work that might have, at an early age, influenced you on the idea of how we use language in poetry. You write in an interview with Rhino, which you can find online, you say poetry is like giving birth to something painful and grotesque. And I'm wondering if perhaps, because you do write about things that are painful and, quite frankly, grotesque, I'm wondering if there was maybe initially at least some sort of, you know, influence of Poe's darkness and Poe's pain and horror that he wrote about?
Definitely. I struggled with depression for basically my entire life. And so when I read his work, it just rang so true. And I finally felt understood. And so ever since then, I think he definitely influenced my aesthetic. And yes, my poems are often dark and grotesque, but I also feel like there's hope in them as well. And so that's something that I try to do. But yeah, I think it's important to look at the uncomfortable parts of ourselves and of our lives and try to make sense of them, or to just revel in the ambiguity of them.
Right, right. And you do that, you know, you write about the painful, not only on a personal level, but you write about it really on a communal level. I'm thinking of that poem called 43 in this collection. And of course, the 43 is a number referring to those students who disappeared and were killed in Iguala, Mexico. And you have this beautiful line towards the end of the poem. You say, "Why waste time with metaphors?" And it, for me, it evokes Pablo Neruda in his poem, Explico Algunas Cosas.
Oh, yes.
That very last image where he says, you know, children are dying in the street. And then he says again, children are dying in the street like children dying in the street. Or no, blood is running in the street. That's it. Blood is running in the street like blood running in the street, as if he's tired of metaphor, as if he's tired of just using language, that he's just so angry. And I'm wondering if there's times when you're writing a poetry. First, I'm wondering if you identify with Latin American poets. Do you? I mean,
right.
We know Neruda, of course, had, you know, kind of a misogynistic element to him, but nonetheless, his work was very political. But then there's also, you know, we have people like Claribel Alegría and Gabriela Mistral, and we have, although he's not Latin American, we have Lorca, we have these Spanish language poets who think
right.
differently and who have more, it seems like, a willingness to socially and politically assert themselves. And I'm wondering, first of all, if you have been influenced by Latin American poetry, and then secondly, if sometimes you're writing about something that makes you so angry that you're tired of metaphor and it has to be an essay or it has to be articulated some other way.
Sure, yes. I've been definitely very influenced by Latin American writers. Neruda, of course, has been very pivotal for me. I read and reread his poems like crazy when I was in my early 20s. And I think I internalized a lot of his aesthetic
right.
and his political inclinations. Also, a prose writer, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, he has been incredibly influential to
right.
me as well. And so I feel like 100 Years of Solitude, I've read it so many times that I feel like it's
wow.
part of my body. And Lorca, of course. Unfortunately, I can't think of any women writers right now, how embarrassing and shameful being a feminist and all.
Yeah, well, it's certainly not your fault. I mean, that's what we've been exposed to. You know, if you look at all the anthologies of Latin American poetry, I mean, they are incredibly male-centered. But,
but
you know what's interesting? As you're reading Neruda over and over, and as you're reading García Márquez over and over, I'm a fiction writer, and oftentimes when I'm writing and I'm following language without any agenda, but I'm just, you know, submitting to the language, as it were, I end up coming up with this, you know, with a line from Neruda or a line from Márquez. For example, there's this one line from Neruda in Poema 20, and he says, a lo lejos alguien canta, a lo lejos. And I just love the rhythm of that. I don't know why, but it's, you know, in the distance, someone sings in the distance. And I think I've stolen that line unconsciously many, many times. And I wondered if that happens to you as you're writing, suddenly a rhythm, a line, a voice comes in, and then only subsequently do you discover that it's Neruda, or you discover it's Lorca, or you discover it's somebody else.
Oh, definitely. Yes. And I think that's inevitable when you're a voracious reader and you internalize work and you feel like it's part of your being and your life. And so sometimes it's hard to separate what you're writing from what you've read. And I think that's just part of the experience of being a writer. I think it's important to be conscious of those things as well and not to like plagiarize or anything like that. But there are lines where I'm like, oh yeah, that was definitely from Reading While Women, or that was from Rilke or Adrian Rich, or, you know, I can identify certain images that I know are influenced by certain writers. But I think sometimes it's fun to see where our images come from, where our language comes from. But yeah, there have been times where I'm like, oh, I stole a line from someone and I went back and I adjusted it because I, you know, that's not okay.
Right.
But yeah, I think it's just part of the process.
Or you could do what a lot of poets do when that happens to them. I assume that this is happening to a lot of poets when they put in the index, you know, that exact quote and then say, this is from a poem by. And I think that that probably happens. You know, the note happens after the poet has discovered, oh, that's where I got that line.
Yes, yes, it did happen to me consciously and unconsciously. And so there are some notes in the back of my book for sure.
Yeah. And if you, you know, if you think about it on another, you know, another realm, another possibility, you know, poetry is disembodied language. You know, I mean, it's sound, it's voice. And what is a ghost but a memory of a voice? And oftentimes when we enter into language, when we enter into poetry, when we enter the rhythm, we, you know, we communicate, if not with the dead, at least with the memory of the dead, and it's inevitable they're going to come out in our work.
That's a very beautiful concept.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, I'm thinking of your poem, Juarez. You know, and it's a beautiful poem, and you know, I live here in, you know, Las Ciudades Gemelas, El Paso, and Juarez, and, you know, not only were the drug wars here a couple of years ago making it one of the most dangerous cities in the world, but it's also, you know, where all those murders of the women took place and apparently are still taking place, although it's not as publicized as it should be. And I'm wondering, this poem about Juarez, how did it come about? Have you ever visited El Paso, Juarez, or was it just something calling to you that you had to write about as a Latina woman or as a woman or just as a human being?
Yeah, well, when I was a kid, we would travel to Mexico by car from Chicago to Durango.
Wow.
And yeah,
That's a long drive.
oh my God, it was. And so we would cross the border once. I remember we went through Juarez. Usually it was through Laredo. Mm-hmm. But I remember being in Juarez and there was like a very specific smell. And something about that smell like haunted me. It smelled like meat, but not in a good way.
Wow.
It was very disturbing. But anyway, I think that in conjunction with reading and researching about these femicides that prompted me to write this poem. And yeah, it's an important issue for me as a woman, as a person. I feel like it's something that does not get enough media coverage. I think people have been desensitized to what is happening. Like, oh yeah, they're just killing women on the border. And that to me is very, very disturbing too, to have something so horrific be normalized. And, you know, of course, if it were white women being murdered, it'd be a different story, you know?
Right.
And so that's something that's upsetting for me.
Well, you really should come to El Paso, Juarez. Maybe we can bring you here to the University of Texas.
I would love that.
I teach in the creative writing department here. We're our own department. And it's bilingual. We have students from all over Latin America and North America. But yeah, I'd love to give you here to do a reading. I bet,
sure.
I bet the community here would respond very strongly to your poetry and to your narrative. But this poem, Juarez, I want to read the very last line from it. It says, well, actually, let me read a couple of stanzas. It's about a woman in a maquiladora, and she works for $4.50 a day. Her nose will not stop bleeding. On her way home, summer is flaming on the horizon. She picks a flower the color of a perfectly painted mouth. I just love that last image because in somehow it's sexualizing or perhaps feminizing the landscape. And and I'm wondering, you know, how the poem came to end on that line.
Well, actually, I have to thank my brilliant editor for that ending because it ended differently. It ended actually with my own experience, and he suggested that I end with the experience of the woman to give her more of a voice, more agency, and that was brilliant, and I wish I would have thought of that myself earlier. But
well, at least you are humble enough and insightful enough to submit to the suggestions of an editor.
Oh, yes. Oh, my God. My editor is fantastic. And so, yeah, I changed that. And I love the ending now because the ending never felt right. And I didn't know why. And once he said that, I was like, yes, that is brilliant.
And it really.
And so.
I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I was just going to say, and it really captures, I think, the murdered women in Juarez. You know, my office at the university here looks out over the hills, the barren hills of Juarez, where many of those women's bodies were found. And it's almost this last line is almost saying these women are a permanent part of this landscape. You know, and when a flower grows, you know, to kind of paraphrase the great Aztec poet, you know, that flower is really kind of a continuation of a life that came before it.
Right. It's such a beautiful but unfortunate and devastating image, I think.
Yeah. I have a lot of other questions, but I'm afraid that I might run out of time before I get a chance to have you read a poem. So I'm wondering, maybe we could have you read a poem, and then hopefully I'll have time to ask at least a fraction of all the questions I have about this book.
Sure.
It's so full of beautiful imagery and language. I mean, just like, my body is a gift like a bowl of coins. I that line really struck me. There's just so much beauty in these lines and in these images.
Thank you.
So I may not get to them all my questions, but would you be willing to read us a poem from Lessons on Expulsion?
I would love to. I actually would like to read 43, which you referred to earlier.
Oh, perfect, perfect.
Mm-hmm.
And do you want to give a little background, or do you think we've already given enough?
I think there is enough context there. It's about the students that were murdered in 2014. And so it's something that has haunted me. I just can't fathom 43 students disappearing in this country. You know, how different it is and how arbitrary it is to live in a certain place and to have such a different experience. Not to say that students here haven't been persecuted, but the fact that these students were disappeared and no one knows where they are. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, there's a history of that in Mexico, and the massacre of 1968 as well.
Right.
And so it's something that to me is very haunting. So, 43. The moment before death, the air inexplicably tastes of wet horse. The chest expands and something unspools like wet vine. In this land of child brides and teenage assassins, a bus full of students dissolves into the mountain mist. A retinue of beheaded journalists mouth clues while the young president delivers platitudes. But what do they matter? The students don't know the kilos of heroin stored below them. A boy of 18, eyes gray as bathwater, charts a man's face under his black mask. Why even bother? The boy wonders. The night's only witnesses, the stars, an ocelot, a single strand of hair caught in a barbed wire. Even the sopilotes won't eat the glut of the unsayable. The bloodbirds hiss and grunt while a man with pointed teeth whistles a love song. Why waste time with metaphors? The body is kindling. The body is a plastic bouquet shriveled at a crossing. The trees bow and weep, but everybody knows the rain revises nothing. The charred bones belong to no one. Beyond the verdant mountain, a caravan of mothers and fathers beg a king's country, the locust of cruelty. Farther, a troop of camouflaged men burn fields of red poppies, those lovely flowers of happiness and squalor.
That was Erica L. Sanchez reading a poem from Lessons on Expulsion called 43. I think we're almost running out of time, but I do have a kind of just another question that I want to ask.
Sure.
About a poem called Love Story in this collection. There's this line that that I think is really fantastic. You say the story always begins with a lie, doesn't it?
Right.
Can you talk about that? Are you not a romantic person?
I'm actually extremely romantic. I am very sappy. And it's a shame that I can't write a happy love poem. That's one of my challenges in life. I will write one eventually.
Right.
That particular poem, however, is about relationship. And so I guess me working through some of my resentment and my pain, that line manifested itself. I don't think that love always starts with a lie necessarily, but that one did. And so... yeah, that's something that I've been thinking a lot about. Like, can I write a poem that celebrates joy and happiness in a way that's interesting? I don't know. I haven't done it yet, so we'll see.
But no, it's a great line. The story always begins with a lie, doesn't it? Because it does sound a little bit negative, but if you really think about it, or if you mull it over for a while, you play with it like a cat plays with a ball, you come up with different meanings of that. You know, like love begins with that initial meeting, and whether or not it's an outright lie, there are some, you know, presentations of self that may not be completely accurate at the beginning, you know. So
sure. I mean, we try to paint ourselves in a certain way so we could be attractive to another person.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's just part of the experience, I think.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Erica, for joining us on Words on
thank
a Wire.
You.
The book is Lessons on Expulsion, Poems, and this is a beautiful book. Congratulations. And
thank you so much. I appreciate it.
I'd like to thank Erica L. Sanchez for joining us on Words on a Wire. And as I said in the intro, she has been a virtual friend for, I don't know, maybe a year or more. And I would like to think that after our conversation, she is a real friend. I'm Daniel Chacon. See you next week on Words on a Wire.